Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, I'm Matt Kelly.
And I'm Matt D'Ancona.
And this is the Two Mats for the week ending Friday, the 16th of February, a podcast with a beautiful view, at least for this week. And that's because I am up in Scotland on my holidays and we're having a fantastic time in Aberdeen.
Well, I am in southeast London looking at the beautiful townscape of the borough of Lewisham. Why would I need to move?
Exactly.
Is it good up there? Is it not? Is it lovely?
It's fantastic.
Oh, good.
It's lovely. We've had we've been in Ballater, where the King and Camilla have got a place, and all the little local shops. All the local shops in the high street have got their by royal appointment crests. So there's
of course they have.
Takeaway called the New Shanghai Takeaway, and it's got this massive by royal appointment crest on it. So that's clearly where Charles gets his chow mein, which is good to know. And then we went up to Inverness. Inverness, what a fantastic town Inverness is. Loads of great restaurants, pubs, beautiful river, lovely islands you can go for a walk in. Thoroughly recommend it. And to get here, we took the magnificent Caledonian Sleeper from Euston.
Oh, really?
All the way to Aberdeen. Ah, it was wonderful. And we're going back down tonight, sadly. But we've had a terrific time. And we saw the most amazing football game at Pittodrie last night, where Aberdeen were 3-0 down after 25 minutes to Motherwell. And then Neil Warnock, who is now the temporary manager of Aberdeen, made a few substitutions, having messed up the initial starting formation, and scored two goals in quick succession. And then after half-time, scored an equaliser. So it ended 3-3, but it was an enthralling spectacle and a great advert for Scottish Premier League football. So well done, the Dons. So what did we talk about this week, Matt?
Well, we talked about that inimitable duo, Keir Starmer and Bob Marley. So I'm not quite sure how to link the two of them. We talked primarily about the difficulties that Labour has been having over anti-Semitism and candidate selection and so on. So that was the main issue.
And then in the second half, we came and talked about fantastic music biopics, didn't we? Because you've just seen
the Bob Marley film. Yes, exactly. Pegged to the Bob Marley movie. So,
what should we call this issue? I mean, I think we've got to park Bob Marley in the title, probably, and focus on the crisis in Labour right now.
Yes.
Is crisis too strong a word? I think
Labour's forever war.
Labour's forever war. That's quite that's intriguing, and we'll induce some clicks, I think, which is the whole point, isn't it? To be totally cynical about it.
Though we disdain clickbait, we love it. That's our motto.
We disdain it and depend on it.
We just
so okay.
Exactly.
Okay. So this is the Two Mats, episode 33, Labour's Forever War. Enjoy. So, Matt, what are we talking about this week?
Well, I think we have to talk about Labour's problems over anti-Semitism and the conflict in the Middle East. Obviously, we're recording this on Thursday, and so we don't know the results of the Wellingborough and Kingswood by-elections. But I think that the Labour shambles this week is something that will outlast the results, whatever they are. And maybe we could sort of kick off and get into the subject by playing a clip of Starmer in October 2020. I don't know if producer Matt could help us out with that.
If you're anti-Semitic, you should be nowhere near this party. And we'll make sure you're not. And if, after all the pain, all the grief, and all the evidence in this report, there are still those who think there's no problem with anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, that it's all exaggerated or a faction attack, then frankly, you are part of the problem too. And you should be nowhere near the Labour Party either.
So that's going back to October 2020, and it's Starmer's response to the Equalities and Human Rights Commission report into Labour's handling of anti-Semitism under Jeremy Corbyn. And why is that relevant to this week? Well, because it's kind of the core backdrop to all the problems that Labour has been having this week. So just to recap for listeners who maybe haven't been following it as obsessively as we have. Last Saturday night, the Mail on Sunday dropped and it revealed that Azhar Ali, the Labour Party's candidate in Rochdale, which is having a by-election thanks to the very sad death of Tony Lloyd, who died in January, had said, this is Ali, had said at a meeting shortly after the October the 7th massacres that the Israelis had connived in what turned out to be the worst day of slaughter for Jews since the Holocaust. And his words were, they deliberately took the security off. This is the Israelis. They allowed that massacre. That gives them the green light to do whatever they bloody want. They, in that case, being Hamas. Now, this is obviously a bonkers conspiracy theory, but it's also, without a shadow of a doubt and under any definition, anti-Semitic. Why? Because it uses the classic example of the ancient trope that Jews invite or conspire in their own persecution. And this is a slam dunk case of anti-Semitism. There's no need to get into the sort of nuance and detail. It really is. In that context, it's worth sort of just putting into the conversation at this point that this week, the Community Security Trust, which monitors anti-Semitism, has reported a 589% increase in the number of incidents of anti-Semitism compared with 2022, two-thirds of which in 2023 occurred after the October the 7th. So this isn't just an abstract question or a matter of semantics or politics or faction. This is, you know, this has real world consequences. Clearly, it seems to me, Starmer should have withdrawn support from Ali there and then. But instead, he waited in until Monday evening when the Mail, the Daily Mail, revealed more. The Mail revealed that Ali had defended the Labour MP Andy MacDonald, who's the MP for Middlesbrough, who was suspended in October after he used the controversial phrase "between the river and the sea" at a rally. That refers to the area between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean. And of that, Ali complained and then said at a meeting, the same meeting it seems, I'm quoting, "The media and some of the people in the media from certain Jewish quarters were giving crap about what he, MacDonald, said." Again, that's explicitly anti-Semitic. The standard definition of anti-Semitism, for people who are interested, is the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition, which Labour has incorporated in full. Corbyn didn't want to incorporate it in full, but it did in 2018. And the second example it gives is an example of anti-Semitism is the myth about a world Jewish conspiracy or of Jews controlling the media, economy, government, or other societal institutions. So again, Ali was clearly anti-Semitic. So there was a second Labour candidate who has been suspended, Graham Jones, on Wednesday. But I think it's worth, I don't know what you think, Matt, but I think that there are two questions. First of all, is, you know, what is and what isn't anti-Semitic in this context? And I think off the bat, it's really, really, really important to say not every criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic. You know, it really isn't. It's emphatically not. It's really not anti-Semitic to say that Benjamin Netanyahu is a terrible prime minister. Yeah. It's not anti-Semitic to say that Israel's response to October the 7th has been excessive. It's not anti-Semitic to support the SNP's motion coming up next week calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. But the things that Ali said were.
Were and that's the problem. Well, that
yes.
And that is clear. Where I'm not clear is where the things Graham Jones said, where he said, quote, fuck Israel. Now, that is open to interpretation. What does he mean by that? Does he mean the state of these people, what they're doing is terrible? Or does it mean fuck the entire Israeli concept, the whole concept of Israel? I don't think it's the latter.
That's sort of open to interpretation, I guess. The bit of what Jones said that's undoubtedly anti-Semitic is when he gets into the question of people who have dual nationality going off to fight for Israel. He says it's against the law and you should be locked up, right?
Yeah, but is that anti?
Yes, it is.
Is it not possible? Right, and I'm asking the question through ignorance. Is it not possible that he was ignorant of the law and thought it was bit like going off to fight for a foreign force of any kind, and it was
first of all, criminal offence? It's become such a. I mean, Labour has been dealing with these questions now for many years, so I would have thought it behoves a Labour candidate to acquaint themselves with the law in these issues before opening their mouth. Secondly, again, going back to that definition from the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, which really is the global standard, it is anti-Semitic to accuse Jewish citizens of being more loyal to Israel or to the alleged priorities of Jews worldwide than to the interests of their own nations. So he was playing, again, into an anti-Semitic trope, which is, you know, what are Brits doing going off fighting for Israel? Slam dunk. And I know that there's a kind of feeling of, well, you know, this is all very complicated, but actually it's not. And people can go to the IHRA website, and he could have done, and every Labour candidate and councillor should do, and just acquaint themselves with the rules. They're really very, very straightforward. They're a lot more straightforward than the rules governing Islamophobia, I have to say. Which is not to defend Islamophobia, but you know, it really isn't. It isn't as difficult as everyone is currently pretending that this is sort of, you know, terribly complicated. You just have to acquaint yourself with the distinction between the Israeli government and the nature of Israel as a Jewish homeland. And it is very, you know, if Labour is serious about driving anti-Semitism out of its ranks, it has to be. Very, very clear about this now.
Well, let me just say that for me, having read about it and thought about it, with Azza Ali, the comments to me, you used the phrase slam dunk. I agree completely. I think there's no room for any kind of explanation beyond anti-Semitism. With the comments made by Graham Jones, and the reason I'm exploring this is because I think it's coming to a bigger question about Labour's reaction. With the comments about Graham Jones, I think there is some context there that he could say, I was expressing frustration, I was ignorant of the law, I did actually think it was illegal to go out and fight. You know, he could just say, I just didn't know and I got it completely wrong and there was no motivation of anti-Semitism there. So that's my view, and I recognise that it's different to your view on that. But the question that I think is interesting is this one of factionalism, or the accusation that Labour is still driven by factionalism.
Well, this is where we get into the really interesting sort of Labour internal party politics. So the Labour left has alleged double standards, and it said that the delay in taking Ali off, you know, disavowing Ali as a Labour candidate, is a reflection of his alleged factional affinity to Keir Starmer, because he was a advisor to Brown and to Blair. And you had people like Owen Jones going out and saying, look what happens, you know, the Labour right get treated specially, the Labour left don't. I think this is complete nonsense. The reason that they delayed, and they shouldn't have delayed, by the way, it was a terrible error, was because the deadline for the ballot papers had passed in Rochdale. And so if they disavowed Ali, there would be no Labour candidate. And the problem with that, and here we really get to the specific, is that Labour fears that it is handing Rochdale to George Galloway, who's standing there.
Yeah.
And George Galloway has a sort of a kind of symbolism in the Labour universe that Nigel Farage has in the Tory universe. You know, he is famous for beating the sitting Labour MP Una King in Bethnal and Green in 2005, and then more spectacularly winning the 2012 Bradford West by-election with a 36% swing. And so what you've got now is a very, very unsatisfactory situation where Ali is still on the ballot paper. He could win and sit as an independent. Or, nightmare scenario for Labour, Galloway wins, and there is a kind of neuralgic feeling around Galloway that if he wins, he'll have a seat in Parliament. He'll be able to use his very impressive powers of oratory to destabilise Starmer. And they are disproportionately sensitive to that. So that was the real background. Yeah. This idea of Ali as being somehow in the inner Starmerite circle is just nonsense. I mean, he'd very early on expressed and written petitions, expressing grave dissatisfaction with Starmer's position on the war. So it doesn't hold water, this idea that it's a return to factionalism. This was a very bad piece of political management.
Yeah. And I think it's clear to me that people who are driving the factionalism are the people like Owen Jones, and who it suits.
Yes.
It suits them to have a very kind of far spectrum position that they can keep hammering. He clearly has nothing but contempt for Keir Starmer. I've been suspicious of people like Owen Jones because I think they're driven by how close they feel to the centre of power, and if the centre of power keeps them distant, then they feel resentful and bitter about that. I just feel like there's this sense that everybody is on one end of a spectrum, and that's not the case at all. Most people are sitting much more in the middle of these issues and think that they're complicated and nuanced, and I certainly think if you extend that out to the general electorate, I think, well, we'll find out when the Rochdale by-election comes about, but I suspect that the people of Rochdale are much more interested in the fact that the NHS is falling to bits and that the local education system is falling to bits and the queues at food banks than they are about the issue of Gaza. And I also think it's really condescending when people say, well, 28% of the electorate in Rochdale is Muslim, so you can expect a massive, pro-Palestine vote and a rejection of this kind of ambivalence that Starmer has been accused of. The Muslims are as affected by the general issues inflicted on this nation as everybody else. And I can't, maybe I'm completely wrong. Maybe it will be a Gaza by-election, but I hope it's probably an election based more on the troubles of this country than it is on the sort of internecine problems that the Labour Party's got on this Palestine or Israel issue.
Well, I think that's true. I also think, though, that the reason the factionalism charge has been revived is because the Labour left always maintained that there wasn't really an anti-Semitism problem, that it was simply a device used by the Labour right to beat the Labour left and specifically Jeremy Corbyn's leadership with. And they are rolling this out as evidence that, in fact, when someone that they see is not of the left, i.e. Ali, says anti-Semitic things, it takes the leadership a long time to disavow him. But in fact, there's a sinister side to that, which is the Labour left has never reconciled itself to the idea that anti-Semitism is a form of racism. They really haven't. I mean, that problem remains a part of Labour culture. And, Starmer has gone a very long way to rooting the problem out. He sacked Rebecca Long Bailey as Shadow Education Secretary very early on in his leadership when Corbyn didn't respond in the right way to the EHRC report. He stripped the whip of him and has said that Corbyn will not stand again as a Labour candidate, which is a big thing to say about your predecessor. So, you know, props to Starmer for taking it on. But the problem culturally in the Labour Party that a huge number of Labour people do not regard, because they see everything in terms of power and powerless, they do not regard anti-Semitism as a form of racism. And that will persist. And the reason it's interesting and important is because if Starmer is heading for Downing Street and Labour is heading for government, these will continue to be issues. And although I agree with you that I think, you know, right now most voters are much more, you know, concerned with the fact that we've just heard that today that Britain's been in a recession, inflation is slightly down, but, you know, still prices are very high, and the NHS is in great trouble. These are big issues. But the Middle East has always been a massive problem for Labour. And I think it has been especially so since October the 7th, because Starmer chose to make anti-Semitism, I think rightly, the sort of frame of his imposition of discipline upon the party and the break with the Corbyn era. But obviously, since October the 7th, sensitivities and feelings and emotions and passions around the issue have escalated to an extraordinary degree, especially in the Labour Party. Not only in the Labour Party. I mean, let's not forget that yesterday, the Conservative mayor of Salisbury was expelled from the party for making anti-Semitic remarks. You know, there are divisions within the Conservative government about where to go on this. So it's not just Labour, but it is particularly, you know, marked in Labour.
And this is the nub of the problem for Labour, is that they're out of sync with the general population, I think, on this issue. They're more polarised than the general population is on this issue. The general population, poll after poll, since October the 7th, has shown, and it's been fairly static, is that there's a degree of sympathy with Palestinian people, there's a degree of sympathy with Israeli people, but the great bulk, two-thirds of people, find it complicated and nuanced and have sympathy with both parties or none.
Yes.
And that's a reasonable position to hold. I think it's a logical position to hold, really, as a bystander, you know?
Well, I suppose, you know, full disclosure, I'm probably more pro-Israel and always have been. But I totally accept. I mean, to look at Starmer's specific problem is that his position is unpopular with many in his party. And so you've got independent candidates now starting to target sitting MPs like Wes Streeting in Ilford North, Stephen Timms in East Ham, Lynn Brown in a new Stratford seat, on the grounds that the Labour Party is being too pro-Israel. So he's got another electoral management problem coming down the line. In November, 56 Labour MPs defied the Labour whip on a ceasefire vote, and 10 front benchers quit, including Jess Phillips, you know, who's quite a significant figure. In January, Kate Azamar had the MP for Edmonton had the whip suspended following comments about Gaza being included as a genocide on Holocaust Memorial Day, all these sensitivities. So it's not going to go away. And now, next week, we have the SNP calling for an immediate ceasefire. Now, Starmer has said he wants a sustainable ceasefire. They're not the same. And he's got a really, really big political call to make here, which is, does he give MPs a free vote? Does he try and amend the amendment so that it says something more to his liking? What I think about this conflict generally is that it is turning into the equivalent of the Vietnam War for this generation. It is, you know, I agree with you, Matt, that it is for a lot of people, you know, a bit of this, a bit of that. But I think also it that was probably true of Vietnam for a lot of people as well. It has extraordinary adhesive quality in that it brings other issues into its sort of immediate precincts, like social justice, like the oddity of hearing people saying reproductive rights are Palestinian rights or trans rights are Palestinian rights. It's suddenly become the kind of maypole around which a lot of political issues dance. And that's not going to change, because clearly the conflict is going to go on in various forms for quite a lot longer. And, you know, one hopes not, but may well yet escalate into a regional conflict. And it is everywhere. You know, you see it in, there was a story this week about a Soho theatre where a comedian had been aggressive towards a Jewish audience member who refused to join in the salutation of the Palestinian flag, and the theatre has had to ban the comedian. And there are just these incidents everywhere, which mean that it sort of stretches from, you know, the Houthi attacks in the Red Sea to Ivy League campuses to the bill that Biden's been trying to get through Congress. You know, it's just, it's very hard to avoid it. It's becoming one of those defining issues, which I always think that that things like this are very important in proving that actually politics isn't just about the economy and public services. You know, I'm not saying everyone in Britain is walking around thinking about this all the time, or indeed any of the time. But the actual practice of politics, and the fact that people who shape politics often have strong views, and always have, this is not just the social media era, means that it will have a role. For Starmer, there's the problem that there's just been a poll, just one poll, Savanta poll, saying that the lead has been cut to 7 points. Now,
by 7 points,
But the narrows to 7 points. It may be that's probably just a one-off, and the Savanta said as much, you know, don't read too much into one poll. But we also know, do we not, that Starmer is incredibly sensitive to by-elections. I mean, he nearly resigned after the Hartlepool by-election. After the Uxbridge by-election, which the Tories held on to, he panicked way out of all proportion over the ULEZ emissions scheme in London. And this led to, where we are now with him on, you know, taking a step back on climate change policy. So I think that he's panicking over Rochdale. It's on February the 29th. And it will trouble him deeply that all this is happening.
Yeah. And I think that it again returns to the theme that we've both visited frequently on this podcast about the depth of Starmer. How much depth is there? And is he a man blowing in the wind, you know, the political winds? Or is he a man who, once elected, and let's, for the sake of argument, carry on assuming, although I think it's, you know, perhaps part of the problem that there is a complacency around the assumption of a Labour victory. But let's assume that he gets into power. And again, where is the boldness? Where are the big ideas? Where is the sense that they can defy a Tory fiscal policy that stretches all the way back to George Osborne, you know, and this idea that there's no money, you know, as Rachel Reeves said the other day, the credit card's maxed out, you know, they're going to, well, as I read Yanis Vanifarakis saying, you know, who I'm not a big massive auto fan of, but he did make the point that this analogy between a nation's finances and your personal credit card is completely fallacious, because your personal income has no correlation to what you spend it on, but the income of a nation has a direct correlation with how you spend and invest. You know, if you don't invest, then you will not generate more income. And this is now, it seems utterly befuddling to me that this has become Labour's default position, is that we haven't got the money to do it. And I think they need to make the money. They need, and it, you know, we've seen time and time again where economies can invest through various different fiscal devices, but you can find the money, and they need to be bold now and say, we're going to spend our way and invest in Britain now to create a better Britain in 10 or 15 years. And what I've seen lately is an indication that they are more small C conservative than the bloody conservatives right now.
Yes, that. But also, I think, circling back to Zagaza, is that if Starmer does become prime minister, he won't be able to, or no one in government will be able to talk about Gaza or Ukraine or anywhere as a faraway country of which we know little. You know, he will be the leader of a G7, senior NATO nation, at a time of grave geopolitical disorder. He may be dealing with President Trump, and he needs to have his internal intellectual ducks in a row before he becomes prime minister, because as nuanced and difficult as these questions are, ministers decide. You know, it is in the nature of being a prime minister that you take decisions. And this crisis in the Middle East is not going to go away. And one of the things that I think there is a certain amount of naivety about is, of course, it would be fantastic if the shooting stopped tomorrow, if there was a ceasefire. But that is not the end of the story. And if Starmer does become prime minister, he's going to have to deal with, let's say, you know, that there's a ceasefire of some duration. That will not solve the problem of Hamas's complete incapacity to be, a good faith actor in future talks. And I think there's a sort of, especially on the Labour side, there's this view that if there's a ceasefire, we move straight to two-state solution talks. No. And I'm not sure that Starmer has got anywhere along that journey. And unfortunately, you know, yes, you do have to devote a lot of your time as prime minister and hopefully most of your time to domestic problems. But if you're the leader of an advanced industrial economy with a major military capacity, you are thrown into these issues daily. And you spend, you know, I remember Blair saying to me once, you know, you spend 50% of your day talking to foreign leaders and discussing, you know, intractable geopolitical problems. Is he ready? I mean, what this suggests is that he hasn't thought this side of the this hemisphere, as it were, of the prime ministerial brain is still developing.
I think what it suggests to me, and again, you know, we're playing COD psychology now, or at least I am, but is that in his deep heart's core, he is risk averse. And I think he's demonstrated it with his response to the changing finances with the £28 billion climate pledge. He's demonstrated it with his reaction to this Rochdale crisis, is that he's tried to find a way through. Now, you could easily argue, well, he showed great courage in coming out and stamping down on anti-Semitism as he did in 2021. Yes, so I might be completely wrong, but I am troubled that the closer he gets to the finishing line, he's starting to show where I would be looking for expansive courage and ambition. He's starting to show signs of conservatism, and that worries me.
Yes, and I think also that he's got to be willing to upset people in his own party in a way that isn't just sort of predictable. I mean, you know, Blair was destroyed not by Iraq, people forget this, but by Lebanon. Prime ministers, in the end, on foreign policy, often end up seriously at odds with their parties. Now, I'm not suggesting Starmer has to go all in with Israel, but he will have to take very, very difficult and unpopular decisions either way in this particular crisis, because this crisis is going to be defining. It's going to go on for years. This is not going to be over by December. You know, even if there is a ceasefire, you know, this is going to be something that we'll be talking about for a long time to come.
I'm sure you're absolutely 100% right on that. And we are going to thank you for listening so far, dear listeners. We're going to be back in a brief moment, and the discussion will change tempo massively, and we're going to talk about something much more fun.
Much more fun.
So
much more
fun.
See
you in a moment.
See you in a moment.
So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Monday is the anniversary of Jarvis Cocker's stage invasion of Michael Jackson's performance at the Brits.
Then on Tuesday, we tell the story of the Spaniard who named Florida.
On Wednesday, the birth of instant photography, the Polaroid camera.
Thursday was the day Dolly became the world's most famous sheep.
And on Friday, the foiled 19th century plot to kill the entire British cabinet.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the Retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Matt, I've got a question for you. Do you know, on our fabulous range of merchandise, what is the most popular thing we've sold on the New Europeans shop?
I think I know, but you tell me.
I'll tell you what it is. It's a bollocks to Brexit passport
That's
cover.
That's what I imagined.
Do you know how many we've sold in the last 2 years?
I imagine a fair few.
2,500.
That's brilliant.
They're terrific. Vegan leather, it's called, which actually does look like leather. It's burgundy.
Pleather. Is it pleather?
Is it pleather?
I don't know. Vegan leather may be more cool than
more
pleather.
Leathery than, yeah. Yes. Anyway, it's been nowhere near a cow. That's the main thing.
No. No bovine mutilation was involved.
None at all. It looks passingly like an old-fashioned European passport.
Oh, brilliant.
It's burgundy, and it's got that gold embossed crest on it.
Love it.
Except on the crest it says bollocks to Brexit.
Love
and
it even more.
It's all very subtle and nice and funny. Anyway, we've sold loads of them. People love them. And guess what? It's going to be our subscription offer for the next few weeks.
Happy days.
When new subscribers join the New European, for as little as £1 a week, for which you get all of our digital content, all of your brilliant culture newsletters, everything we do online, and full archive of newspapers and great features. Or if they spend another £1 a week, they get the newspaper, which has a retail price of £4.50. You can get it for an extra £1 a week, delivered to your door every week for just £1 a week, you'll get a free Bollocks to Brexit passport cover.
Fantastic.
What could be better?
I don't think anything.
Imagine standing in the queue to passport control.
Imagine
ostentatiously
it.
Waving.
Just imagine.
Bollocks to Brexit passport cover.
The sheer
cover.
Sense of national pride.
Because you're in that queue for about an hour and a half.
International
now.
Pride and joy.
Yeah. Anyway, if you want to take up this fantastic offer, go to theneweuropean.co.uk/2Matts. That's the number 2, MATTS. Do it now while stocks last.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
So, Matt, big week at the movies.
Yeah, and time for the joy. We had a very serious, yeah, hardcore first half, and you know had to I think because it's the big subject of the week. But let's talk about something joyous, which is the new Bob Marley movie, One Love, which I saw last night, and although I am going to be contrarian again. As is my want, because all the critics have been dumping on it, right? They've been dumping on it.
Oh, no.
So snooty and, you know, oh, it's too respectful, right? Well, all I can tell you is this, and imagine the scene, your co-host and employee at a East London cinema last night, dancing and singing in the aisles, right, with the audience, along to
amazing.
The songs of the great man. It was a wonderful experience.
Were you literally dancing in the aisles?
Not in the aisles, but in the seat. But people were in the aisles singing along.
Fantastic.
And dancing to One Love. It's directed by Ronaldo Marcus Green. Kingsley Ben-Adir plays Marley. It covers the period 76 to 78 when he made Exodus, you know, which is one of the great records of the 20th century. And it is respectful, and it does portray him as a legend, but he was a bloody legend, you know, and it doesn't gloss over his infidelities, as some have claimed. So I loved it, and I was completely perplexed by, you know, comparing that with all the kind of doomy, oh, you know, it wasn't critical enough, from film writers who I know that if it had been too critical of Marley would have been saying, you know, what an outrage, you know, how dare the white supremacists of Hollywood come out, you know, this is what makes me hate film critics, is not judging a thing on what it's meant to do. This is a celebration of one of the great and also, it's what we need. It's what we need right now.
And where does this sit in the great pantheon of music biopics then?
Well, I mean, I wanted to sort of get your take on what biopics you think are pop biopics are great and which ones aren't.
Let me kick off with one that it came out, and it's no exaggeration to say that it helped mold me as a person, which was Oliver Stone's The Doors. And I became entranced with Jim Morrison, as many sort of teenage boys do. And it sort of does veer you off a certain sort of, you know, it clearly found an affinity with my natural disposition, and I became very moody and sulky and kind of artistic and boho, and went off to Pere-Lachaise to sip Jack Daniels at the graveside and all of this stuff. But the interesting thing about that film, if we put Jim Morrison to one side, is I watched the film again recently and I thought it absolutely sucked. I thought it was terrible.
It's really interesting. This points to a very important point about the biopic, the pop biopic, is that you can love the subject and be entranced by the movie and then come back to it and think, hang on, did I really like that? Just some undoubted turkeys. Okay. Dennis Quaid as Jerry Lee Lewis in Great Balls of Fire. I mean, it's worth watching for the terribleness of it, okay? Another one, which I recommend to you if you want a sort of fun, so bad it's good movie, is called Elvis and Nixon. And this has Elvis... No, it's brilliant. And wait, it's got Elvis, played by Michael Shannon. And Nixon, this is the genius, played by Kevin Spacey, right? And it is just a turkey of Olympic standards. And the other one I always think is just unbelievably terrible is a movie that came out 4 years ago called Stardust, which is about early David Bowie, but has no Bowie music in it.
It was awful.
Yeah. Awful.
But what did you think of the other Bowie film, Moon Age Daydream? Because I'm slightly conflicted on it.
Yeah, well, I like that, but I think documentaries are really different. So going back to Bob Marley, the Kevin MacDonald documentary that came out in, I think, 2012 is, you know, is if people feel that this movie is too sort of much of a pageant, go back and watch that documentary for, a more the documentary approach to the subject. I mean, Moon Age Daydream, I suppose, was an attempt to make the medium the message, wasn't it? Which was, it's psychedelic. Yeah. It was very sort of, the style was very, very important to the message. It wasn't just a sort of talking heads movie that you'd expect.
In terms of one film that really nailed it for me in terms of a music biopic, it was Control, about Joy Division and Ian Curtis.
I was going to say the same. Brilliant.
Isn't it? It's just majestic, isn't it? You know?
It is. I mean, it might be my favourite because Sam Riley as Ian Curtis, Anton Corbin is a director who had been one, you know, photographed the band during their brief existence. And I think it captures in its sort of black and white severity something very, very distinctive. But it's also a very good drama.
Yeah. And in terms of like top two or three biopic films, then if we've got Control towards the top, any other recommendations. Well, I've got a couple in mind, but you go.
I have a fondness for Sid and Nancy.
Uh-huh.
I know it's not great on the other members of the band, as Mr. Lydon has often made very clear. But I think Gary Oldman's depiction of Sid Vicious and Chloe Webb's of Nancy Spungen is brilliant. So I like that. And yeah. I think it has a sort of a tragic, elegiac feel about it, which is very powerful, Alex Cox movie. So that's one.
Yeah. And I'm going to broaden the genre a little bit, but he was a pop musician of his time. So I'm going to say Amadeus.
Oh yeah. Amadeus is a rock and roll movie. It's a great movie. It may be the greatest, actually. Yeah. I mean, Tom Hulce may be the greatest performance of a rock star ever. With all the kind of Freudian father fixation stuff thrown in, and it's a gorgeous film. And of course, the other reason that this is kind of something to be thinking about is that there's much sort of big drum roll going on at the moment for the release of Back to Black, Sam Taylor Johnson's biopic of Amy Winehouse, starring Marissa Abela. And the trailers look good. I don't know whether it'll be... Amy Winehouse is a subject about which people get terribly prickly, and it feels quite recent. I don't know whether it will be as good as some suspect. I hope so. Yeah, I really do.
Yeah, well, it's following one of the greatest music documentaries, Amy.
Exactly. Which won an Oscar? Yeah.
It's a tough act to follow. Also, I do feel like, God bless her soul, but at least she's dead, and people can start to form an historic view of her. Whereas stuff like the Elton John biopic that came out,
Rocket Man.
I just thought it was up. Rocket Man, that's it. I would put that in the dustbin of history, honestly. I thought it was absolute shit.
I'll tell you one we haven't mentioned, which has slightly faded from memory, but I thought was absolute knockout, was Straight Outta Compton in 2015 about MWA. Yeah. That was a
Paul Giamatti, yeah.
A really good film. Another one which is forgotten is... Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll about Ian Dury with Andy Serkis playing the great man. And it's sometimes these lesser ones. So I had a, and this may be totally unfair, but I had a kind of allergic reaction to Bohemian Rhapsody, because I just knew that it had entirely been made to get Rami Malek an Oscar.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
It was everything around it. There was a kind of caption underneath, vote now. And he got an Oscar, and it was a very good it was a perfect impersonation of Freddie Mercury. You couldn't knock the guy. Whereas with One Love, it probably was a technically less remarkable film than Bohemian Rhapsody. But I didn't note when I went to see Bohemian Rhapsody, maybe I went to the wrong performance, I didn't see anyone getting out of their seats and dancing and singing to One Love and Redemption Song and Three Little Birds, You haven't seen, until you've seen me do Three Little Birds,
I'm just going to throw one more in, which I don't even know if it fits the category. But I think of all the films we've mentioned, it's the one that if I had to watch again tonight, I would watch this one. And it's 24 Hour Party People.
With Steve Coogan as Tony Wilson.
Absolutely brilliantly funny as Tony Wilson. And, of course, a big Joy Division connection with that one as well. But Tony Wilson, and I think, the more I think about him, what a remarkable guy he was. He was when I was growing up in Liverpool, he was the BBC Northwest TV guy.
Granada.
Who would go out and do... Yeah, Granada. That's right, Granada. Sorry, not BBC. And he'd go out and do Vox Pops in the streets of Manchester and stuff like that. And he was living this... bipolar life where he was also the impresario behind Factory Records, and the
unbelievable.
Hacienda. And
unbelievable. Or
incredible guy. Incredible guy.
Let me ask you I'll put my hands up to start with to make it easier. Do you think our generation, Matt, are hopelessly in love with that era of Joy Division, Factory Records.
Yeah.
I am. I know I am.
We are in that. It's like, I remember that scene about in Mad Men when Don Draper's doing his presentation about nostalgia, and he explains what nostalgia, you know, it's the pain of memory, you know, the pain of never being able to go back. And I feel it deeply about the late 70s and the early 80s, you know, the pain of not being able to go back, because it was such a joyful time, even though you were surrounded by, you know, awful social deprivation and economic trash. It was all before everything started turning rosy again, you know, but there was something beautiful about it.
I think that's right. And I think that it's interesting. Bernard Sumner says about Joy Division that because there was so little beauty around them, they found it themselves. And he said, we didn't really know that at the time. But that's what they were doing. And the music stands up. At least I think so.
Oh, 100%.
I really do.
100%. Well, that's a beautiful note upon which to end this week's episode.
Go see, if you're feeling depressed by politics, go and see this movie. It'll really cheer you up.
Brilliant. So please, as ever, get in your questions and any feedback you've got to tomatts@tnepublishing.com. That's the number 2, MATTS@tnepublishing.com. Or if you listen on Spotify, you can just message us there very simply. And that's what Andy Smith did. And he said, "Hi, Matt. Given the dwindling sales number for daily print newspapers, why is it that politicians seemingly continue to be fearful or scornful of headlines and allow that fear to influence policy?" That, Andy Smith, is a fantastic question. And I think it's one we should address on our Q&A on Sunday, don't you think?
Yeah.
Yeah. Andy and everybody else, join us on Sunday morning for a Q&A.
We'll
address that at the top of the show. We're back on Sunday, as we've just said. Remember our fantastic subscription offer. If you like what you hear on the podcast, you will love the New European newspaper. So go to theneweuropean.co.uk/2matts. There's a link in the show notes and you'll get a fantastic deal on a subscription. Just tell them I sent you. Thank you as ever to producer Ollie Peart at Rethink Audio, assisted this week by the brilliant Matt Hill. And until next week,
it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.